because of Kosovo and things like that, we are seeing that evolution, which I'll come to in more detail shortly. And then there's the microchipped population, which was very funny when I first started talking about this years and years ago, except now it's being introduced. Under this layer of world government is designed to be the European Union, which evolved out of a free trade area, the European Economic Community, just a free trade area, nothing to worry about, and then we evolve that stepping stone style to the centralized fascist European state. NAFTA, just a free trade area, nothing to worry about. Mr. Mulroney and Mr. Bush both got together and said, if you're so good for trade, oh, that's good, oh. And so we're now stuck with NAFTA, which has been great for the Canadian economy, apparently. And then you get the Pacific Union, which is designed to evolve out of APEC, the Asia Economic or Asia Pacific Economic Cooperation, which was set up in 1994 at a meeting in which Bill Clinton was a main attendee. And under that come nation states and regions, which in Europe, of course, are now subordinate to that. And then you get to the people. That's the idea and the structure we're aiming towards. And again and again, when you turn on the news, you see the rapid movement towards that. This guy with the patch on his chest works for the CIA as a scientist. I mentioned at the start of the talk. He told me when I met him, what, 2-3 years ago now, that microchips were so small you could insert them with hypodermics in vaccination programs. And this picture, sometime later, has come out in a British newspaper from a university, Huddersfield University. It is a massive blow-up, as you can see, of an ant, and it's holding a microchip in its little pincers. That's how small they are, and getting smaller all the time. And the barcoded person symbolized in this picture, we are moving towards very rapidly as we become embroiled in a network of technology in which we can't go anywhere and do anything of significance without some technologies recording it. Again, that's the idea. And if George Orwell had called his book 1994, he would have been spot on. And George Orwell came from a level of knowledge that the agenda existed. Now, that structure I've just talked about, which we're aiming towards and moving towards rapidly, if that was offered openly, then there would be a massive reaction against it. People say, that's a global fascist state. We're not having that. We want to know. We want to decide what's going on in Canada. Come on. Don't have that at all. So you have to use a technique, one of many mind and emotional manipulation techniques, so that you get the people who would normally oppose the agenda to actually see the agenda as a good idea or the only solution to problems you create. Now, in the upper levels of Freemasonry, they have a motto, Ordo Ab Chao. That means order out of chaos. The idea is that if you want to change society from the status quo to advance it into the image that you want it to be, if the status quo is working and you have harmony, you are gonna have one hell of a job to get people to change that society. So you need to create problems in the status quo, which you can then offer solutions to. They just happen to be solutions that reform society in the form that you want. And what the Freemasons call order out of chaos, I call problem reaction solution. And it works like this. If you were offering your agenda at this point openly, as I said a few minutes ago, there would be a reaction against it. So at this point, you break the status quo up. So the status quo appears not to be an option. You create a problem. You make sure someone else is blamed for it, like some lone assassin, and you make sure that it changes the status quo in some way. It could be a run on a currency. It could be the collapse of the Canadian currency's value. It could be a war at its most extreme. It could be a government collapse. Any of these things. A terrorist bomb. You then get the media, which you also control at ownership level, and by lack of vision and courage at journalistic level, often, you get them to report your problem in the way you want it reported and to blame the people you want blamed. Let's analyze this for a second. When a major event happens, like Oklahoma or a war or whatever, in the first 24 to 48 hours, Waco's another example, you are given the official version of that event. Just listen to the journalists talking and writing. FBI sources say this, White House sources say that, government sources say this. In other words, the explanation in the immediate aftermath of a major event is what the government explanation is. That explanation is at the top of all the newspapers, front page, because the events just happened. It's at the top of every radio and news bulletin. That goes around the world. This is what happened at Waco. This is what happened at Oklahoma. Then people who are interested in what really happened start digging away. And again, the official version is demolished. Where is that reported? Not at the front page of every major newspaper, not at the top of every global news bulletin. In small circulation books, in small circulation newsletters and papers and magazines. And so, decades after the official version of these events has been demolished by research, stop anyone in Sydney, Australia, in London, in Vancouver, and say, Waco, Oklahoma, and they will regurgitate the version they heard in the first 24 to 48 hours, which just happens to be the official version. This is how it works. So stage one, you create the problem, you get the public to be informed about that problem in the desired fashion. So getting the public to say, something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it? Enter the sting. Those who've created the problem and glean that reaction then openly offer the solutions to the problems they have themselves created. In this way, people are demanding that an agenda is introduced or allowing it to be introduced when if it was offered openly, they would oppose it vehemently. Problem, reaction, solution. And when you look at Oklahoma, just as an example, whether Timothy McVeigh was involved or not is open to debate. What is not open to debate on the evidence, I would suggest, is that not only he was involved. As independent bomb experts who spent a lifetime in the military have confirmed, the bomb that caused the Oklahoma horror, 168 men, women, and many children, killed and maimed others, could not possibly have been caused by a fuel fertilizer device in a Ryder truck. It had to be caused by a very high-tech device on some of the pillars, or the building could not have fallen like that because it was an immense building. And it's interesting that some of the parents of children who died in Oklahoma started doing some research, made themselves very unpopular, and they established that the target, apparently, of Oklahoma, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Department that was involved in Waco, nobody from that department was in the building when the bomb went off, but they were in full combat gear around the building an hour before the bomb went off. And when you look at the background to Oklahoma that you're not told about, quite clearly, there is a great more information to know than we're being told, which would put a totally different light on what happened there and why. And why did it happen? Problem, reaction, solution. You have to have the solution to the problem. Purely and only because of Oklahoma. Anti-terrorism bills went through Congress on the nod, not a word of challenge, which took away basic freedoms in America and gave more fascist powers to the security forces and the military. Within 24 hours of Oklahoma, Bill Clinton was calling for an easing of restrictions on the military's involvement in domestic law enforcement. Problem, reaction, solution. And there's no better example of that than the Second World War. Wonderful example. You had this Illuminati, this global elite, and this is documentedly provable. They had by this time, created Russian, which became Soviet communism. Lenin and Trotsky were funded from Wall Street and London. Provable. Why? Because if you're going to create a conflict to divide and rule and change society in your image, you have to create the sides to play off against each other. So by the time the Second World War was about to start, they had their front man in Russia called Joseph Stalin. In Britain, they had another front man who came to power just when the war was about to start in earnest, Winston Churchill from the Marlborough bloodline, Blenheim Palace, as I mentioned earlier. Aleister Crowley's mate. And in America, they had one of the great front men in the presidency for the Illuminati of the 20th century, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who's related to the Bush family. Over here, the Teutonic Knights network of the Illuminati was bringing to power, through these various secret societies, the network that manifested as the Nazis. And the Nazis were funded from Wall Street and London. The Rockefellers funded the Nazis through Switzerland. The American and British German subsidiaries in Germany funded the Nazis. One of the funders of the Nazis was the Harriman Empire in America, who funneled money through an organization called the Union Banking Corporation, Director Prescott Bush, father of George Bush, and that Union Banking Corporation interfaced with the banking and steel empire of Fritz Thyssen, who was exposed publicly after the war as being one of Hitler's major funders. And the Harriman organization, incidentally, was one of the major funders of the eugenics race hygiene movement, now called population control in the Third World, where they are using aid to force women to have abortions and be sterilized, even if they don't want to be. And if people want to talk about being pro-choice, then they have to have a choice, women, both to be sterilized and to have abortions and not to have them if they choose. Dr. Ernst Rudin was one of Hitler's, in fact, probably Hitler's main race hygiene experts. He occupied a whole floor of a German university to experiment in his race hygiene insanity. Who paid for that? The Rockefellers from America. The world is not black and white, it's shades of gray. And so you had this situation where the two sides were created and then they were played off against each other. And what happened? You had 55 million casualties as a result of that war, of all different races, colors, and cultures. Massive problem. The second global conflict in just a few years. The end of that global conflict, this world, particularly Europe and North America, was mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually exhausted. What did they say collectively, understandably? Something must be done. This can't go on. What are they going to do about it? Solution? An explosion of globally centralized bodies, the United Nations and others in finance and politics of various kinds. Why were they created and justified? As a solution to the problem of global war, which the people that introduced them had created. Between the two wars, the First and Second World War, a document came to light out of London, and an American congressman held it up in Congress and said, what the hell is this? It was called Propaganda in the Next War. The interesting question when it was exposed was, what friggin' next war? No talk of a Second World War at this time. And in And the Truth Shall Set You Free, I print what it says in detail. What it says in summary is this. We're going to have a problem manipulating American public opinion to go into another war in Europe and allow their sons to go into another war in Europe so soon after the last one. What we need, it says, is for another country to attack an American state, so creating a problem, an outrage, which leads to America going in the war. I kid you not, it says in this document, Japan would be perfect. 1941, Japan attacks Pearl Harbor, problem. Reaction, outrage. Solution, America's in the war. This is how we are constantly manipulated. And so that has produced a complete change in global society, exactly as it was designed to be. And if anyone thinks that it's not possible for a few to control the world, that is the proof of it. Because the simple question, how many people in America, in Britain, in Canada, in Australia, in South Africa, and all these countries that sent their sons to fight in that Second World War, how many of them wanted to be there? How many in Germany wanted to be there once they saw the horror of what war really was? Hardly any of them. So why were they there? Because this little hierarchy manipulated this country and its soldiers to believe they had to fight this country. This country's hierarchy manipulated its young people to believe they had to fight this country. And these two hierarchies lock into one hierarchy that was playing both sides. Because if you want to control a game the way the Illuminati want to control a game, which is to know the result before the game started, controlling one side is no good. You will influence the game, you can't decide the outcome. There's unknown quantities. They want to decide what the result's going to be before it starts. So they work through all sides, so knowing what the outcome's going to be, because they're controlling it. And there was a song, I think it was written by a Canadian, Buffy St. Marie, which was recorded by a guy called Donovan in the 60s, which sums up the futility of war, but also where the real power and responsibility is for this. Because wars only take place because we fight them. If we didn't, they wouldn't take place. And his song went like this. He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will, killing for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA, and he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how could Hitler have condemned him at Laval? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from here and there, and you and me, and brothers and sisters, can't you see? This is not the way we put the end to war. And if we could just learn one thing as a human race, we could end so much of this manipulation. When we stop playing the game, there is no game. The horrors of what we do to our fellow human beings did not end in Germany. What about Rwanda? What about Burundi? What about East Timor? What about Cambodia? It didn't end in 1945. Just changed its face. And unless we start facing not only the reality of what's going on, but get out of our black and white vision of reality and start looking at who's behind it, then we're going to see more of this in more countries. And we're going to call it a free world. And I just want to mention this, because it's about time the black and white mentality was put to rest before it allows this to run its course. The Rothschilds are, they claim, Jewish. When you mention the Rothschilds, you're anti-Semitic. Well, how about if the Rothschilds have mercilessly manipulated Jewish people for centuries? What about if they're still doing it now? Let me tell you a quick story for those who have a problem with talking about the Rothschilds. When I was in South Africa with Credo Mutwa and met Winnie Mandela and talked to her too, I got this strange call from the daughter of P.W. Botha, the apartheid president of the 1980s. And I was asked through his daughter if I wanted to go and talk to him, because he'd seen me on the media talking about the manipulation and was interested in what I knew about South Africa, because I went along to meet this guy, not expecting to like him because of the apartheid thing. I left feeling, what a pathetic experience, because he seemed to know genuinely so little about the manipulation that goes on. He named the classic names that were manipulating South Africa, but he didn't realize all the other countries are naming the same names. And we talked about the Rockefellers, and we talked about the British royal family and the manipulation from Europe, and then the Rothschilds came up. And he said to me, you know, I had a very strange experience, he said, in the 1980s. He said, I got an invitation to meet what he called the English Rothschilds in Cape Town with his namesake, but not related, it seems, Pik Botha, the foreign minister in South Africa during apartheid, a serious piece of work, this guy, and very much an Illuminati front man in South Africa, Pik Botha. And he said, when we had this meeting in Cape Town, this is in the 1980s, he said, the Rothschilds told me there was massive wealth in Swiss bank accounts that used to belong to German Jews that was available for investment in South Africa if they could agree an interest rate. This is the very wealth that in the last few years has come to light in Swiss bank accounts. The Rothschilds, who, if you name them, you're anti-Semitic, have been using it horrifically to make interest profit on since the war. The world is not black and white, it's shades of grey, and if we don't realize that, these guys are going to walk all over us. Along with problem, reaction, solution comes this technique, the stepping stones approach. That is, you know where you're going, but you know if you go in one leap, people are going to look up and say, what's happening? What's happening? What's going on here? So you do it in little steps. This is how we've moved from a free trade area in Europe to the centralized superstate. Little steps. And every little step is projected to the public as totally unconnected to all the others. So after a few years, you look back and you think, well, how did we get here? I didn't agree to this. Been done in stepping stones. Exactly how it works. James Madison said, I believe there are more instances of the abridgment of the freedom of the people by gradual and silent encroachments of those in power than by violent and sudden usurpations. The stepping stones approach, being used on us all the time. This is how NAFTA is being manipulated into the American Union. Now, the structure of secret societies is that you create a pyramid structure and you have to go through different levels of degree. And until you get into the higher level, you don't know what knowledge is held at the level above you. Compartmentalization. Keep them in the dark and feed them bullshit. It's a wonderful system. Now, the world is controlled by a global version of that. If it works, why change it? Which is this. Every organization today is a pyramid, if you look at it, virtually every organization anyway, the very, very few exceptions. Every bank, every business, government, university, a media operation, it's a pyramid. You've got the tiny few at the top who know the agenda of that organization, how it works, how everything fits together. As you come down the pyramid in these organizations, you're meeting more and more people, but they know less and less about the big picture. They just go to work. They're not trying to manipulate the world. They want to earn some money, go home, give their family a good life. But they don't know, someone here in the military, for instance, how what they're doing fits in with what somewhere here in the drug corporations are doing, or somewhere over here in banking. The only people that know how this fits together are the tiny few at the top. Same in every organization. And the structure by which the world is manipulated is pyramids within pyramids. So you'll have a bank pyramid. Someone down here, you hand the check to over in the local bank, won't have a clue what's happening here, and he won't have his clue what's happening here, etc. The bank then goes into the next pyramid in the structure, and eventually you have the global banking system pyramid, and at the top of that, the same families control the financial system. Here you have a transnational corporation, which in itself is a compartmentalized pyramid. It goes into the transnational global network, and at the peak of that, they're owned and controlled by the same people, and they're the same people that own the banks. It's very, very lonely up there. The same names keep coming up. And all the way through this, politics, education, media ownership. And this centralization of power, which has been going on incessantly, is now in our face. Every time you turn the telly on or open a newspaper, some mega global banking or industrial or media empire is fusing with another mega empire. What's remained under the surface is now becoming visible as it manifests into the structure it wants the world to be. And this pyramid structure is so important to understand how it works. So throughout this century, for instance, we can see in all these areas how power has incessantly centralized and gone into fewer and fewer hands. This is not an accident. It's because they all fuse into the same basic core, and down from that core comes the same agenda of global centralization, and it manifests here in our everyday lives. It's the same with the political parties, the one-party states. I've done this for America and Britain, but it's the same everywhere. Down here, where they knock on the door and they put the funny hats on, the congresses and stuff, and they say, vote for Ethel, they genuinely believe they're in different parties. But when you go up to that level, you again fuse into the same people. In America, the present Democratic president is Bill Clinton. He locks into the Rockefeller network. The last Republican president was George Bush, who massively locks into the Rockefeller network. Quite possibly, as I speak, the next president is going to be George W. Bush, who locks into the same network. But of course, in the last two elections with Clinton, we've had Ross Perot. Thank God. Lord, thank you for Ross, an independent man. Ross Perot. Billionaire, multi-billionaire. He ran a little company, you see, in Texas. And he got on the road to billionaireship because he had this massive contract from New York State. Now, there's plenty of companies in New York State could have fulfilled the contract, would have kept the money flowing in New York State. What you might think the state might do. But no, it gives the contract to this little company in Texas, and Ross is on his way. Who gave him the contract? Nelson Rockefeller, four times governor of New York. Same group. Locking in to the same